me go straight to the point. Let me try to give you a bit of context. So, well, this is, so I'm not in the wrong meeting here, so. of course, this is not what we are going to talk about. I think this is a very good example of what we could consider a successful endeavor in science. And, you know, this is, weather forecast is something that still amazes me in the sense that I wonder how we were so good in developing this scientific program. So this is a huge enterprise, if you think of it. Well, you know, nowadays for us it's just normal. We click on the web and we will see what will be the weather tomorrow, in 2 days, 3 days. Well, we know that there are a few problems from time to time. Things are not so good as we would like to be. But you know, and this is a huge thing, in the sense that, you know, this is something that combines science in the last 300 years. So basically we have first to develop, you know, the basic theory of thermodynamics, hydrodynamics, then turbulence, then we have to go into the very detailed equation of what are called the primitive equations of for atmosphere and weather. You know, these are things that, well, I don't know really what is written down there, you know. And then that's not enough, because then we need data. We need a lot of data. So we have not just to have you know, a few measurements of weather scattered here and there. At a certain point, if we want to have reliable weather forecasts, we have to bring satellite on the orbit and then try to get a complete map of temperature, pressure, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, at that point, you know, people were starting to think, well, we will be able at this point to know the weather as much as we can. It's just a matter of computational power. And this is not. So, you know, complexity, actually, chaos theory gets in. We know that there are some intrinsic limits to what we can understand. But, you know, we can cope with that. And then at a certain point, big supercomputers get into the game. And that's wonderful because, you know, well, a few years ago, to have forecast of a tornado or an hurricane was basically an impossible task. So you have all the data, and to calculate, you know, the movement of an hurricane, you could take 1 week of CPU time. And actually, the hurricane in 1 week was already several hundred miles away. So you know, now we do this in real time. So this is a great combination of effort. And, you know, in physics, if you go into physics and chemistry, we do also magical things, you know? Well, yeah, you know, these are the things that are done in material science. So we look at what happens in a material with 1.6 million atoms, and we study how it fractures. You know, that's something that numerically is not intensive. It's still miraculous for me that we're able to do that. You know, and then we can do, you know, we can do plasma simulation for finite elements, for 6.8 billion finite elements. So these are incredible things. And so at this point, you know, there is a very simple question. So why we are not able to forecast the spreading of diseases? So we have all these apparatus, we have simulations, we have data, we have everything. So what's the point? Why we are not yet able to do that? So what's the main difference with respect to the other cases, to weather, to material science? Well, let me try to tackle this issue. Start from the epidemic modeling 101, so that we can fix the framework a bit. So how it works, really, the basic of epidemic modeling. So the basic is that if we want to have an understanding of the macroscopic scale of how an epidemic spreads, we have to give up the description of the details of the specific disease. So we don't care about, you know, your specific symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. What we say is that we divide the individuals in compartments with a certain label that basically just tells you if an individual is susceptible, so he can get the disease, is infectious, so he spread the disease during his everyday activity to other susceptible individuals. In some cases, you recover from the disease, and so you define a class that is called the recovered class, because you acquire a certain immunization to the disease, and so you cannot get the disease again. In some other cases, the recovered compartment would say that you are dead. That's in a certain kind of unfortunate point you see that we have two basic elements. One is the compartment of the disease, and then we have these parameters, beta and mu in this case, which are just transition rates. So these are very simple probability or rates that describe what is the probability that a susceptible in contact with an infectious individual will become infected, what is the probability that in a unit time step an infected individual will recover, and so on and so forth. So basically now all the disease, the what is called the etiology of the disease, so the property, the properties of the disease are summarizing these parameters. And then we have to describe what happens to the evolution of when we introduce in a population a few infected individuals. Well, you know, the basic point of epidemic modeling is the homogeneous mixing assumption, in which you say, well, you just have an infected individual, so you bring into the population, and we consider this population as a, it's like shaking a sand in a box, so everybody is potentially in contact with everybody, okay? So this is what we would call in physics a mean field assumption, basically. And, you know, and we look in time to what happens to the system. This means that, for instance, if we talk to the, we think about the basic SIR model, which is the model usually considered as a first approach to diseases, if you want to describe mathematically the model, you get a set of very simple equations, deterministic continuous equation, which are mass action law, basically. So you see that the number of susceptible individuals change in time as a function of the infected and susceptible. There is a factor n here that is the total size of the population, because what happens is that each susceptible can become infected if in contact with an infectious individual, but this probability of contact will be proportional basically to the density of these infected individuals. You know, we have the parameters, and at this point we can just look at what is the evolution of the epidemics. And what we are interested in general is the density of infected individuals in time. And there are three stages which are usually considered in this in the framework. Well, the first one is what is called the pre-outbreak. This is a stage in which you have a few infected individuals in the populations. Of course, since this is a stochastic phenomenon, at this stage everything could happen. So you can have just by fluctuation the disease could disappear from the system. So an infectious individual is not able to contact any other susceptible, and the disease disappear. And of course, this is not considering continuous deterministic equation. Well, at a certain point, if you have enough infected individuals, the disease will start to spread in what is called the free spreading phase. That actually is the linear approximation of this equation here. And then, you know, you get the peak of the disease, and usually you get into a stage in which is called the cleaning stage, in which the number of recovered individuals gets more and more, and the disease fade out of the system. If the disease is endemic, so a susceptible recovered individual can, after a certain time, become susceptible again, you can get into this stationary state. Well, this is important because defines what is called the epidemic threshold, in the sense that you know, you have a characteristic time for the exponential rise of the disease. And this time basically is, if you look at this expression, is just a function of the basic parameter of the disease, and you have a condition. So to have a factor here which is positive, that tells you that the epidemic explodes exponentially, you need to have beta over mu larger than one. Basically, this is what is called the reproductive rate. So each infected individual must be able to infect more than one infected individual during the disease, during his time period as an infectious guy. Well, at this point, the question is, well, of course, if you're talking about this kind of model, you will never be able to do weather epidemic forecast. This is too simple. So possibly the problem that we have is a problem of mathematical models. But this is not the case, because actually, you know, the complication of the system is something that is being considered in mathematical epidemiology since at least 100 years. And so we can go from the homogeneous mixing that I just shown to you as a very simple toy model of epidemics up to the very complicated agent-based models, in which basically you try to follow person by person with realistic data, possibly, doesn't happen always. And you know, you look really at the realistic spreading of the disease. So, you know, And there are all intermediate possible framework that have been developed. So social structure, you include that, you know, not all individuals are equal. There are age brackets, genders, work habits, et cetera, et cetera. There are contact networks in the sense that you forget about all the social structure things. You just try to say, well, each individual, say, want to map the contact of these individuals in one day, in 1 hour, whatever, in a very detailed perspective so that I can get a complete contact pattern for the system. And then, of course, you can go also at a larger scale and you say, well, let's look at multi-scale models. If I have an epidemic outbreak in Los Angeles, well, how it will affect New York. Of course, you need to have some infectious individuals traveling from Los Angeles to New York. And so you have to define what are called metapopulation models, in which you have populations, and then these populations are connected among them, and so on. Of course, there is a price to pay when you do that. You go from the very simple, so something that mathematically, usually, you are able to address and solve analytically, to something that is not transparent at all. Basically, you just plug everything into the computer, and then you look at what happens at the end of the day.
So it's sort of cool with the weather also.
Sorry?
But that is what happens with the weather as well.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, in some cases, well, there is much more control than that. But, you know, we are going in that direction. This is the point that we will see. So, as you see, the problem is not really the mathematical apparatus. So it's not that we don't know how to describe the systems also in a very complicated way. So what is missing? Well, for a long time, what was missing, for instance, were monitoring infrastructure. So what kind of data we have? How we know if a disease will be in a certain place or another? Well, this is something that now we started to address in a way. You know, now WHO has monitoring centers. We have, daily report on what happens to all the diseases. So we start to get a monitoring infrastructure for infectious diseases. The etiology analysis, up to a few years ago, it was very difficult to see, well, what is then, how I map, if I discover a new disease, how I map into certain parameters for the model. Now we can do this in a much quicker way, and also we are addressing this point in a way, and that's because of the monitoring infrastructure. Well, how you detect different strain for infections. Well, also that is now possible. We have gene sequencing. So, you know, basically in a couple of weeks from the emergence of the first few cases, we can know almost all the information that we need for the modeling. So all these points we can start to deal with this issue at this point. So what is still missing and why we are not able to do forecast, basically, is because of the collective human behavior. So this is what is really the problem with epidemic modeling, as well as other issues. So, you know, this is involved social phenomena. So it means transportation network, our habits, how we go to work, what we do, and especially also how we react when we know that there is a disease or there is an emergency. So there are a lot of issues to consider. So somehow, and this is what is very surprising, you know, it was easier to send satellite in the space and map completely the temperature of the world than having good data on how people is commuting from home to work. So this is what has been missing for a long time. What is changing, however, is also that, and this is what opens finally, I think, the perspective of epidemic forecast. Now we are getting data. So now we are getting a lot of data on transportation infrastructure, behavioral networks of people, a lot of census data on a very detailed scale, commuting and travel patterns. And this we can get at very different scales, so from the international level to the very intra-city level. So all these kind of things are putting us finally in the position to start tackling the issue of, can we have forecast? Yeah?
Yeah, I have a nice question. So in the case of, for example, the bird flu, where human behavior is not involved, is that problem better solved?
No, well, the human, no. Well, this is something that is completely different. The alien flu basically is not yet a human disease. It's just something that's
spread.
It's a disease. Indeed, we know a lot about that. So we know we have all the gene sequencing. We know what is the virus, how it works. We know that we have. We are in the phase 4 stage of a pandemic, so in the sense that there is no such thing. same human to human transmissibility. So we know a lot. Of course, what we cannot know perfectly is how birds migrate from one place to another and how they go from one place to another. There is people working on that, for instance. So just to understand how is the flow, let's call it the commuting flow of birds. But you know, this is but it's of course it's not yet something that you can control completely. So the issue of the avian flu would be in the moment that there is sustained human to human transmission. Yeah. There was another question. Oh, okay. So how this why I'm taking this into this this workshop is because most of the networks that we need spreads are in form of the data that we need are in form of networks. So basically what we have, you know, this is for instance is, you know, county daily commute trips in the United States. This is North Carolina County, you know, and you get a network in which you have all counties which are connected by a directed flow of people that commutes from one place to another. And you can get that for all United States and basically a large part of Europe. You can go up to this day. You have data at the intra-city level. So there are several work like EpiSims and Epicast in which people are trying to map what really each individual does within a city. You see that there is a person ID, so what it does during the day, it goes at work at 8, it goes, it gets a coffee at 11, it went back to work at after 20 minutes, and so on and so forth, you know. You get all this data on what people do within a city, but also in that case, you have a network in which you have location, you map the location of a city into a network, and then you try to see how people goes from one location to another.
Actually, your data, you didn't know whether he goes for a coffee or met a girlfriend.
Yeah. In some, you have, you know, there is a level of course grading, of course, and usually.
Because you only know he left work and he came back, so you don't know whether he did something that he would.
Well, actually, this should be known, and actually, there is not really the coffee place, but there should be a mall. Actually, there is some location in which he has spent a few minutes at least. Well, what's the interesting part? The interesting part is that the data that we are getting are challenging us, also from a theoretical perspective, because this data, you know, points everywhere that we have heterogeneous networks. So these networks are very complicated. So here I don't want to talk about if we have networks with a certain power law exponent or another, whatever. I'm just talking about the fact that we have high heterogeneity. So all these distributions are skewed at far from Poissonian, whatever you do, okay. And you get very skewed distribution, both in the degree, both in the strength, and that means, you know, the traffic flow on this network, and so on and so forth. There is also something nice about this data in some cases, is that contrary to other area of investigation in which there is a problem with the data because they are not complete, biased, et cetera, in these cases, for instance, many of these data sets are, I would say, are complete. You know everything, okay? Well, at this point we have several challenges. The first one is, well, we need to do data integration. So we need to get all this data, plug into models, and try to construct, to really build a computational infrastructure for epidemic forecast. The other part is, well, what is the effect of this mobility network heterogeneity and complexity on the epidemic spreading? And here there are, anyway, you have two levels of understanding. One is, well, what happens in realistic simulations? What we do in terms of, so what is the effect of these networks on the realistic epidemic forecast? And the other is, can we draw a generic, general theoretical framework for the effect of network on epidemic spreading? And, well, this, for instance, started several years ago on a single population. So what happens if the epidemic spread on a single in a single population, but the contact pattern of the single population is not homogeneous, it's not the usual Poissonian contact pattern, but for instance is a scale-free network or is an epitale distribution in general. Well, it has been shown that you know, the epidemic threshold in the thermodynamic limit vanishes. So basically what we have is that the heterogeneity of the network is favoring the spreading of epidemics. And what you get is that in the end, in principle, in an infinite system, that of course in reality is not possible, but in an infinite system, the epidemic will spread also for a very mild spreading rate. And then you can get all the results about, you know, what happens to the density of infected individual and so on and so forth. There has been a finite size effect studied, validity in the case of assorted even these assorted.
What is lambda?
Here lambda is the effective spreading rate, is the bit over mu, basically. So it's the effective velocity of spreading of the disease. Of course, a lot of studies on immunization policies, and then of course there have been some rigorous results. There is a nice paper by Christian and Jennifer on that. Of course, a lot of work by Mark Newman that related this epidemic spreading with and the SIR model with percolation and so on and so forth. So this is, however, is a, I would say, is a first proof that, you know, the heterogeneity of the network has a very strong impact on the framework that we have for the epidemic spreading. So things can change radically if we consider the heterogeneity of the system. Well, what happens if we are in this in the context of the forecast? But at this point, we are not just looking at a single population. We are looking at, well, in principle, we should look at the world. Then, of course, you have a problem, a multi-scale problem, in which you have all systems nested into each other. Because from the world, you can go to the single country. From the single country, you can go to the intra-city, then from inter-city, then intra-city, and so on and so forth. So at a certain point, we have to decide at which scale we want to start addressing the problem. And you know, we can go from the very detailed agent-based modeling of all cities, of what happens within a city, to the world scale. And you know, in principle, one would like to have, you know, to describe all the world in a kind of macroscopic agent-based modeling, which we take all the 6 billion individuals in the world, and then we look at what happens. So this is still numerically not feasible, especially because of the we lack data. Well, one way to do is, for instance, if we want to have a worldwide forecast, is to work at a kind of intermediate scale, that is the one of metapopulation models, in which we consider various populations that you can see as cities or urban areas, and these urban areas are coupled together by traveling fluxes of people. So basically here you have a network that is the network of people mobility from one population to another. Then you have the population with each, the number of individuals within each city or urban area. And then you describe the disease within each urban area still with a compartmental model that of course if you're going into the realism side must contain much more compartment than what I thought with the simple SIR model. So we need all hospitalization, latency time, and symptomatic cases, and so on and so forth. Well, what is the typical example? The typical example is the global spreading on the airline network. Why this is interesting? Well, because if we're talking about the diseases with a short infectious time of 2 or 3 days, like influenza, usually influenza-like illness, well, this is the way the disease spread, okay? Because this is the time scale of the airplane is the one that is comparable with the disease. And so this is what is determining basically what happens on the large scale. And this is an idea that is, you know, is a very, old idea that comes, you can trace back to the 70s from a group of Russian scientists that did this kind of analysis on the Russian airline network at that time. Well, some Russian guy told me that is not true, but there is a kind of legend that when you read this paper, they are telling you that at that time in Russia, you need a visa to travel even from city to city. And so that basically they had all this transportation data from city to city. Then I talked with the Russian guy and he told me, well, it was not true, but you know, well, so they have all this complicated model with 40 to 80 cities in which they have all the flow of people among the cities, and they did start to do the numerical integration of the system. That was a very tough job at that time. You can imagine 40 cities, and they were integrating mostly by hand all the things. So it was a very tough job that then has been picked up by Longini, Ira Longini in the 80s, with more urban areas worldwide. And then, of course, along the time, you know, you get more and more city, more details, and so on and so forth in the game. And now what we do is to push basically to the limit this, because we can use the complete aviation association database. And that means a track of all flights in the world. Let me show you how it looks, because this is a very complicated network, and if it works, you never know. This is a very nice visualization of flight patterns. This is from the Federal Aviation, and this is our flights in the United States. And this is what's happening basically every day in the United States. And just to show you how much it's complicated, each of these trays is an airplane, basically. And this is the real-time follow of the airplanes. And you will see at a certain point that now it's night, and you will see at a certain point that the East Coast picking up, and because it's morning, and then, you know, everything that starts to, you see, this is the East Coast, then shifts, and airlines take off from the West Coast, and so on and so forth. You see that, you know, the continental flight are coming from Europe in the afternoon, and you see, you have all this complexity, all this. This is a huge network, basically. This is a huge network in which, with which you have to work. And well, the first thing, as a network scientist, we do an analysis of it. The issue is that we don't have just a problem of connections here, degree or topology. Here we have also an issue of weights. So we have that the adjacency matrix. We have to consider a weighted adjacency matrix, otherwise we are lost. Because as you can imagine, we have a lot of connection with a huge traffic, and most of the connection with a very small traffic. Okay, so we have heterogeneity also on the coupling, not just on the topology. And this is just to give you an idea of what you get when you do the analysis. That is the degree distribution, so the number of connection of each airport. And this is a skew distribution, more or less two orders of magnitude and whatever. But look at the weight distribution. This is essentially the number of passengers per link. So this is the probability that you have a certain number of passengers on a certain link. And you will see that you have six orders of magnitude of variation. Now at this point, as you see, I don't care if this is a power law or a Bible distribution. It's just that I have six orders of magnitude of variation. You know, and then of course, this is, for instance, is the probability that a certain urban area has a certain population, a given population N. As you see, this is basically the zip flow. So this is nothing very, very, very new in general, this one. And also you have very nice non-linear coupling, for instance, between the population and the people traveling from the urban area. This is something quite unexpected. There has also been a few recent work by other people like Luis Bettencourt, in which you see that, you know, basically, for a long time we were expecting that the larger the urban area, the larger the number of people traveling from that urban area in a linear way. So you expect that just that there is a linear scaling. And this is not true at all. Basically, you have non-linear relation among the things. So you have to plug in all these things and then see what is the effect on the simulation. So, well, we plug in where? Well, the first thing is to say, well, let's construct this model. First of all, if you want to do forecast, you have to, to relax the fact of working with continuous deterministic equation. You need to introduce the stochasticity in the system, otherwise you are just looking at a diffusion process that is not going to give good prediction. So what you do is to generalize within each city. Now for the moment, let's consider a very simple SIR model. You generalize within the city the equations of the epidemics, but now you do real extraction, random extraction. So each equation is just a set of random extraction which are following a binomial which is determined by the etiology of the disease. So basically you are transforming the average equation into the stochastic equation for the disease evolution. You have noise. This is something simple that you can do in a few lines. What is more a problem is to decide what to do with the traveling. So what do you do? Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing is to adopt again a mean field perspective. You say, well, what is the probability that a person in the city J will travel to the city L? Mm-hmm. Well, the first approximation to say is that you just have the flow of people traveling in a certain unit time, for instance, one day, if this is the discrete time you're using to integrate equation divided the total population. So basically, your probability to travel is just a random extraction of that is proportional to the number of people traveling divided the total number of people in the urban area. That's a very simple assumption that you cannot work with. Then you have to generalize that. You have to make it, again, stochastic. So you have to do random extraction.
Isn't it the case that when they study these things, they find that there are certain people who are traveling all the time, who are the vectors
you have all these 20-20-20-80 rules. Basically, you have 20% of the population that is traveling a lot, while 80% is not traveling a lot, and all these kind of things. These ingredients can be included in the game in Western countries. We don't know really what happens in other countries of the world. There is a lack of data. And this is something that I want to make sure. In all the things that we show now, I'm trying to minimize the number of parameters. So I don't want to plug in things that I do not know. So the only things that I will use are data from the real transportation, from the real census. Okay, that's it. And the etiology of the disease, that of course is the three parameters, because the etiology of the disease will change depending on which disease I want to describe. Well, we have to generalize, we have to make it stochastic, we have to make it a multinomial extraction because people can travel on different routes. There are several other issues that we have to consider. Finally, you get a transportation operator that basically is telling you in a stochastic way how many people enter in a city from different other cities and how many of the people will travel outside of the city. And finally, what you get is just that. So you get a basic set of equations, one for each city, that are stochastic equations coupled through stochastic coupling terms determined just by the traveling pattern of people, by the mobility network, in order to get the evolution of the disease worldwide. And this is, you know, for a simple SIR model, you get 3,100, we have 3,100 urban area mapped. Basically, you get 3,100 equations times 3. If you're doing realistic modeling, you get times 10 or times 20. So this is the scale that you have of the problem that you have to solve. But actually, it's not so. It's not so
20. So rather than SIR, you have a lot of different.
You have to consider compartment as people that is infectious but asymptomatic, so doesn't go to the doctor.
Okay.
The people that goes to the doctor and get certain drugs and so on and so forth. So of course, you have latent individuals.
So instead of a three-state model, you have a
usually
three-state model.
A realistic model for disease, for epidemic spreading of real diseases is about from 10 to 20 compartments.
Okay.
So this is, of course, you let's work with that for a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So what exactly is the binomial?
The binomial is just the transition. For instance, each people, the recovery time in an influenza-like illness is usually on average 3 days. So basically, the binomial is that one, it will tell you, you know, I have a certain pool of infected individuals, how many of them recover in that unit time? And this is a binomial extraction. You know, then you have binomial extraction for the number of infected people that get in contacts. This is basically, you just transform the deterministic equation that you have in the stochastic equation. It's nothing more. If you want later, we can just.
Do the parameters depend on the population size of cities?
Yeah, no, you need that. You need that. This is another part of the data. You need for the 3,100 urban areas, you need to know how many people are there. This actually is the tough part in terms of data. It's easier to get all the full map of people traveling in the world than getting really how much people is in each urban area. So now there are several projects that we are combining. So basically, you are constructing a kind of Voronoi isolation of the world, you know, with the closest distance to each airport so that you have basin of attraction for each airport and so on and so forth.
But within each urban area, you're still taking well mixed?
You still do the mixing. That also in the stochastic equation, we are doing just the binomial extraction. So we are doing, you know, we are just considering Poissonian processes, if you want. I'm not considering the full map of what happens within each city. That is out of scale at the moment. So this is what we need to do at a certain point. We will need to do. Well, at this point, there are two things. You know, first of all is applications, and the second thing is a basic theoretical issue. So what is the effect of the heterogeneity of these real networks on the disease spreading? And the first one is application. So let's see if it works, and if it works, what kind of prediction I can get out of it. At this point, the talk could, well, let me first try to, you know, if we construct all this monster, we need to, I need to convince you that more or less it could work, because otherwise it's no point, you know, yeah, I'm just doing SimCity. So, well, the idea is to do scenario forecast, and so, well, there are many other things that you have to include in the realism, seasonality, more compartment, test various things, geographical issues, at the end you get mapped. So, the first thing that you could ask me is, well, let me show what happens for the next pandemics, for the H5N1. Well, at this point the talk would be interactive, so you could choose what to see in the next 20 minutes, but you know, the idea is that if this would take a long time, I could show you what happens for this next pandemic. However, you are not yet convinced that the method is working. I would just pull out numbers to you, and but you say, well, why should we use this number? So let me address these issues. So first, the prediction and predictability. What is the prediction offered by this computational method, and what we can understand, and why it's we can do some kind of forecast? Well, the idea to do that, what we have to do is to get an historical data set. An historical data set is the SARS, because this is a very well reported epidemic. So basically we know almost everything about this epidemic, case by case, city by city, a lot of data from the WHO. The idea is that to get a model not developed by us, by this computational infrastructure, but by the epidemiologists that provide a good realistic description of the disease, plug into our model and see if evolving the equation we get something which is reasonably in agreement with what happens with the real case. Well, here there is a first issue, because this is a stochastic phenomenon, and I have just one realization in the real world, and I have to compare my data with the real world. So many of the there are previous work that were comparing average values and things like that with this disease. But you know, if you get an average value, it's not really significant with respect to, you know, I do many runs of my simulation and I compare the average value. This is not what I want to do. So I want to consider the stochasticity of what I'm building. Yeah.
So is it possible instead to look at something like the flu? So can you predict how many, what's the percentage of the US population that will have the flu next year instead of looking at something so dramatic?
This is not dramatic. Actually, you use this case, well, no. There is something that you expect. Well, you know, this is so dramatic. The SARS is not a dramatic case. It, relatively, there are very few cases. So here I'm pushing to the limit my prediction test. The influenza is much easier to predict, because it's mainly driven by seasonality effects and affect a large number of people, the seasonal influenza. So what I have is that it's more likely to have good prediction. You know, in all this model, the more cases you have and the more you get into mean field description, that is, you know, your stochasticity and the heterogeneity of the network is less important. You have a lot of people infectious traveling more or less, yes, it's more homogeneous. But I could show you later also that. So we did this exercise, of course, and you get well, there is also a problem because influenza is multi-strain, there are data, there are, well, I should spend some time. So let me go in that. And this is, first of all, let me have the statistical prediction. So what I show is a map that provides this outbreak likelihood in the world. So basically you go that from a 0% probability that you experience an outbreak in a country, to 100%, so in each realization of my process, I get an outbreak in the country. Okay, now I'm running on the computer, so I'm simulating one story for the disease, a second story, and so on and so forth. And I need to understand what is the probability to get the disease in a certain country. Of course, my description is much more refined than that. I can go to the level of the single city, but otherwise it would be very difficult to manage visually that. Sorry?
What does outbreak mean? One
outbreak,
case?
It's even one case.
Okay.
So as soon as you have, well, actually, the exact definition is that you need to have one secondary case. So you need somebody who is arriving there and is generating at least another infected individual. This is the map. And so you say, well, good, because more or less you see that the red is where basically the epidemics happen. So, but how you control that? Well, what you do is to do some thresholding, and you say, well, let's define a risk threshold that is the 10%. So each we consider at risk each country that has had more than a 10% probability to experience the outbreak. Okay, this is what, if I would be a WH person, I would like to know. And what you get, this is the map in which in red you have what we consider risk country, and in stripe, white and red, the country which are not at risk. And you see that all of them match with what happened with the real epidemic. So what is not at risk in our simulation didn't experience the epidemic. And what we consider at risk experienced the epidemic. The, you know, the green, actually, the highlight in electric green is where we are wrong. I want to make clear that you don't get 100% good prediction. And you see that we are wrong in Japan, we are wrong in Mongolia, and so on and so forth. Some of these regions is easy to understand why we are wrong. Well, Mongolia, there is an issue to understand, to get data on how people move there, because most of the population is nomad, and you know, there are things like that. You know, there are other places like, you know, we don't have data on Iraq, we have problem in Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. What is more puzzling is why we are wrong in Japan, but also that we could explain. Well, this is however is probability. Then can be more quantitative. So can we really see if we get good numbers? Well, here you see our statistical prediction compared with the real report from the WHO country by country. And you see that basically what you get is that for a large number of countries, you are basically getting the right number. And then for some of them, you know, you don't get the right numbers. This is the part in which we are wrong. Well, I have to tell you that, yeah, this is really because I want to be honest. But you have also to understand that our prediction here is not even one order of magnitude different in some cases. Well, we're talking about populations in a country of millions of individuals. So we're predicting 200 cases instead of 100 or 60, but in a population of 60 million. So you have to understand that this is not a crazy prediction. So even when we are wrong, basically we are in the ballpark. So at the end of that, if you summarize all these things, my reaction was, this is too be good to be true. Because what you get is that basically you get in 210 countries over 220, you get correct predictions. And then you say, well, how it is possible also quantitatively? Well, and especially how it is possible given that, well, this is a complex network. Actually, this is not the airport network. That's a mock-up. This is it's an autonomous system. But, you know, the complexity is similar. Why, you know, you have stochastic noise. You have this complexity of the network, and then you get prediction, because you would expect, well, the disease each time can go everywhere else. You know, each story should be different. Well, actually, this is not the case, and this is something that takes some time. Really, you have to develop, you know, certain tools to monitor the stochastic realization in the epidemics, et cetera, et cetera. But what you see is that there are two competing effects. One is the topology that is very complicated, but on the other hand, you have that the traffic as well is very heterogeneous. And the traffic basically is compensating for the mass of the topology, because you have some kind of preferential pathways along which people will travel the most. And then, of course, these are preferential pathways along which the epidemic will spread. So since you have such an heterogeneous traffic network, what you get is that basically there is a high predictability in the system that is determined by the complexity of the network. And you know, this is what you get, for instance, in the case of SARS. These are what we define the epidemic pathway. So if you look at where the first case, infected case, come from, you see that in most of the cases, with almost 100% probability, the case arises always from the same city. So you see, you can map at the state level, at the country level, these epidemic pathways. Of course, there are epidemic pathways which are less strong, like here in Europe, you see that in Spain, the epidemic pathways is split in three cases, you have a 33% probability on different countries. But you know, this is telling you that basically the predictability of the system is due to the fact that we have some defined epidemic pathways defined by the complexity of the network. And then, of course, you can use that to, to try to monitor and control, given the initial condition of the disease, you can expect that where the disease will come from in different countries. So you can use this kind of information. Well, at this point, I could show you the data on the pandemic and go into a lot of.
So before you go back to basics, can you comment? So you said you had some idea why you went wrong on Japan.
Yeah. Well, the fact is that, as I was telling, I don't want to add any ingredient that is not under my full control. So I know the parameter of the disease given by epidemiologists, I know the transportation network, the census data. I cannot, however, discriminate the fact that in Japan they have very different habits from us. So they are very strict in terms of the disease. I don't know. You know that if you have any flu or influenza in Japan, you immediately put a mask on your face just for respect to the other people. You don't shake hands because you know that you are sick, and so you are not going to shake hands and things like that. This is something cultural that, however, it looks like very effective. So the spreading rate in that country is much lower than in other countries. And then during the SARS epidemic, they were very good at enforcing all possible controls. Do you remember that there were all the pictures showing people in Japan in the street, everybody with masks and things like that? So this is the reason why. But I cannot quantify that in a way. So I could quantify, but I should guess. And I don't want to do that, you know, at this level. So, of course, if I start to tweak parameters, I can get also Japan.
You can't measure that?
There are some proto-measurements. So that tells that these kind of habits can give you a reduction of the effective spreading rate of about 20 to 40%. But, you know, this is a large bracket. Of course, I can plug it into the simulation. We did it again, so and of course you get right, but you know that's an easy way to get the right answer. So just in 5 minutes, let me go back to the basics, because this anyway is interesting probably for the mathematical side. Well, now if we want to do something more than just put things on the computer, what we have to do? Well, I'm a physicist, so what you can think is, let's look at this metapopulation model as a reaction diffusion system. That basically is bosonic, so in which on each node you have a multiple occupancy. So what we have is that, for instance, we can imagine particle A and particle B, two type of particles. Of course, one will be the infected individuals, the one the susceptible, and then a reaction process of this kind, which is very simple. This actually would be equivalent to an SIS epidemic model. And what you have is that you have people wandering around this network of nodes. In each node, you can have as many individuals as you want, with a certain diffusion rate that basically would mimic the traveling probability. Now, to make things simple, because we want to go back to basic, you imagine that the particles, you know, will have a certain diffusion rate B and a certain diffusion rate A. Then you know that they will diffuse out of the node with a probability that is divided the degree. Immediately you get that in the stationary state, the number of particles in each node is just a function of the degree, so it increases in nodes with a large degree. And so you get immediately a population which is somehow skewed as the degree distribution is skewed. At this point, however, then you have to define the reaction process, and you imagine that each particle that is in the same node, in the same population with another particle, can react. And of course, at this point, there is a problem of networks of networks, so we have to decide what to do in the population. One thing is to do what we do in the real models over there. So you have a reaction rate in which each individual has a certain finite probability to meet a certain number of individuals, not more than that. In other cases, and this is valid for instance, in the debute limit, et cetera, you might enforce that each individual may contact all other individuals in that population. And of course, a real graph will be between, for each population, will be between these two extreme cases. Well, at this point, you know, we can write equations, and we have to consider what is the, basically, the heterogeneity of the metapopulation network. So we write equation for the number of individuals in a species, in the species A or species B, depending on the degree of the population. And you can get the basic reaction diffusion system for the basic reaction rate equation for the system. These are mean field equation, and now since we are going back to basic again, they are continuous equations, okay? Well, of course, there is a diffusion term, and there is a reaction term, and this reaction term depends on the kernel of reaction that we want to use. So a very well-connected population, or a population in which you have just a few individuals meeting from time to time. Well, and then we can study some basic properties. For instance, the first thing is that the topology of the metapopulation network does not have any effect in the limit in which you have a certain fixed number of contacts. So basically, in this case, even if the population is very heterogeneous, you have the usual framework of a metapopulation model in which you have an epidemic threshold. The epidemic threshold is determined by the effective spreading rate, and nothing else happens, even if you have this very big mess of the heterogeneity of the network. Instead, if you consider the other limit, what you get is that the epidemic threshold, as for the single population, but now we are in a different framework, we are in a metapopulation model, so we have bosonic occupancy. You know, we have a transition for the epidemics that is determined by the average number of particles in the system per node at a certain critical threshold that, however, is affected by the topological properties of the network. So you see here that there is the ratio between the first moment to the square divided the second moment. And so if you are in an heavy-tail network, basically even a small number of particles of individuals are able to sustain the epidemic. Principle in the infinite limit in which you have an infinite metapopulation model, the threshold is zero. So again, you have a big difference. Now, I don't want to, this is really too late. That could seem a very oversimplification for the system. However, you can compare this with real data. So you can measure the reaction diffusion system or the real data-driven model on the same network. And you see that basically, you know, the behavior and the things are very, very similar. So even a basic reaction diffusion system is able to capture somehow the properties of the real mobility network. In one case, we are not considering the transportation, the weights, everything is not considered, is homogeneous, the diffusion rate. Here, the diffusion rate in the data driven model is from real data. And you also get for both limits, so for both limits of high contact or low contact rate for individuals. So you see that somehow you get into a description that starts to make sense also for the realistic model. What is missing a lot? First of all, since there are a lot of mathematicians, the solutions are far from rigorous. So what we obtain is with mean field theory and there is no stability analysis, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a lot of rigorous work to do. Then we miss completely, and we don't know yet how to introduce in the analytics the heterogeneity of the weight. So we are doing a reaction diffusion processes in which basically just the topology is affecting the diffusion rate. We need to understand more the reaction scheme. There is the problem of stochasticity. These are continuous equation. There is the full integration. So what happens if in each population we have a certain degree distribution, a certain pattern? And then, of course, you know, we can imagine also to have the response of individuals. So individuals might do different things in different cities, have a kind of quench noise on different population, more diffusion in a city than in another, et cetera, et cetera. So there is still a lot to do, but I think this is very important to lay the foundation of what we would call an epidemic forecast, because we need to understand really what are the limits, the predictability limits, what is the basic framework for such a computational infrastructure. And this is just a few works. Well, some of them are now really in medicine journals. So, and this is, for instance, is about the pandemic, and other instead are more interesting about reaction diffusion, mathematical methods, and how we can understand what happens at the metapopulation. Thank you very much.